Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and if you've spent any time with this podcast over the past year or two, you'll have noticed that one topic keeps coming up again and again. GLP-1. The drugs, the biology, the market disruption, the questions nobody can quite answer yet. We've covered it from a lot of different angles, and today we're bringing the best of those conversations together into one episode, a complete GLP-1 story in four acts. We start with the science, what GLP-1 actually is and what it does in your body. Now, although GLP-1 is often in the news for a lot of people, even those working in the food industry, the underlying biology is still a bit of a mystery. That's where Caterina Silva, Science Integration Manager at Rousselot, and her colleague Florencia Marino Torres come in. And I started by asking Caterina for an explanation of what GLP-1 is and does.
So GLP-1 is a hormone that we already naturally produce in our body. Every time you eat, so eating is takes a lot of work to take all the nutrients into the right places. So in order to coordinate all that, you need a project manager, right? A good one. And GLP-1 is that type of project manager that makes sure that every organ in our body is doing what it needs to do in order to put the nutrients in the right location. So whenever you eat, food ends up in your intestine, and in your intestine you have this famous K and L cells. These cells are triggered by the food to secrete these hormones, GLP-1 and GIP. GLP is also very important, although less famous. And then GLP-1 and GIP go into the blood, and they will reach out the pancreas. And in the pancreas, they'll tell the pancreas to produce insulin. And insulin will then take the sugar, like holding the glucose molecules by its hand, and take it directly to the cells in our body. Without insulin, most cells in our body cannot receive glucose. That's why it's such an important hormone. So that's step one. But step two, we all have a tendency to overeat. So it's very reassuring to know that our body has already systems to prevent that. And one of those systems is the slowdown of the gastric emptying. And that's where GLP also plays a role. So GLP-1 also tells the stomach to slow down the gastric emptying, to give you this feeling that you're full. And this way, it makes sure you don't overeat and you don't tend to eat more sugars than you have to. There's even a second line of defense, which is, of course, your brain. So your brain also has receptors for GLP-1. And GLP-1 will trigger your brain into send a message that you're full, you don't eat to eat anymore, so everything is okay. So GLP-1 is really this project manager that coordinates the actions of your pancreas, your stomach, and your brain to make sure that you don't overeat and you can manage the glucose levels that are in your blood.
Brilliant. Excellent description. You mentioned another hormone there, GIP. So, you know, I work on a food podcast and I work in the news sometimes, and we're talking about GLP-1 all the time. I've never heard of GIP. Now, that might be my own lack of research.
But it's the less famous sister of a GLP-1.
Okay, so let's learn a little bit more about this less famous sister. How does it work alongside GLP-1, and why does it matter?
Two-thirds of the insulin produced by your body are actually signaled by GIP. GIP for healthy people is the most important hormone. It's less famous because, of course, when you study science, you study diseases. So you study diabetic people. And diabetic people, unfortunately, lost the sensitivity to GIP. So, of course, when the pharmaceutical were looking for drugs to help diabetic people, they looked for an hormone that has a stronger power, and that one is GLP-1. But if you're healthy, everything should work together. GIP and GLP-1 work together in order to give you all these benefits that you will experience with these two hormones. So the eating is the most famous one, but GIP is also very important for your bone, for example, for your circulation. It even helps you with the memory. So, and that's why it's so important, and it's such a pity that the diabetic people lost this sensitivity to this hormone, that the new drugs being developed actually have these two drugs together. So the GLP-1 and GIP together, they can potentiate each other. That's why Florencia mentioned they're like these two sisters that work together, and they make people lose more weight, and they minimize the side effects. So that's really the reason why you really is better to give to these people something that mimics more what happens when you're healthy. And when you're healthy, you have these two hormones together.
So the drugs that we're hearing about in the news that people are getting prescribed now or buying, do they have GIP in them or are they purely GLP-1?
The first ones were pure GLP-1. The new ones have GLP-1 and GIP. So the second generation of drugs are with GIP as well.
And they're more effective, essentially, you're saying?
Yes, and they have less side effects. One of the side effects of only GLP-1 is nausea. And the goal is really to try to minimize these side effects, and GIP agonists can help with that.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. Very good explanations there for a few questions that I think our listeners would like answered. Florencia Russolo uses a really vivid phrase that stood out to me, the glucose roller coaster. I wonder if you could describe what that actually feels like in the body and why it matters, even for people who sort of consider themselves to be healthy.
Yes, of course. Well, the glucose roller coaster is actually a physiological effect. If you don't have a little bit of a roller coaster, you are probably dead. So that's the start.
So it's a good sign.
Yes, exactly. But the problem is as follows. The glucose roller coaster itself goes this way. We eat carbohydrates or we eat sugar, we eat starchy foods. But when the quantity is a lot, it's like we go on a roller coaster and you go, you know, into the mountain and you go very high. So me personally, when I eat cookies, I love my cookies. I feel super happy. Life is good. I'm ready to go, especially if I'm with my coffee. So I'm in a high. I'm in the high of the roller coaster. However, of course, after this high comes a crash. And this is what we know as a sugar crash. And then in this crash, we can feel fatigue, de-energized, sluggish. We start having a lot of cravings. So then we go back again and we eat more cookies, more starchy foods, and we get locked in this vicious cycle. So as I mentioned before, it's a physiological effect when you eat, let's say, a balanced diet, not ultra-processed foods and so on. So then your highs are not so high and the crash is not that strong. But honestly, in our daily life, our diet is not like that most of the times. And actually, a recent study, the whole study led by in Stanford University, found out that 80% of the healthy population already showed an excessive glucose spike after eating a bowl of milk and cereal. So that means that this thing that we would consider to be super healthy, maybe just like, I don't know, your cornflakes with your cereal, can lead you to have this sugar crash. And the problem, again, we said is that, okay, you can feel fatigued, you can feel a bit sluggish, start craving more. You get locked in this vicious cycle, you eat a bit more. And in the short and medium term, what are we going to have? We're going to have things like weight gain, being craving all the time, being even stressed and moody. So all these are consequences of the glucose roller coaster that maybe we don't think a lot. But in the long term, if these fluctuations keep on happening consistently, it can lead to more serious metabolic issues like diabetes, hypertension, etc. So that's why it's very important to keep this concept in mind and think how we can control it in our daily lives.
So that's the biology. Now let's look at the scale of what's happening with GLP-1, because the numbers around adoption of the drugs are genuinely astonishing, and they have direct consequences for everything from supermarket sales to restaurant footfall. In this clip from the Food Matters live event in Dublin, Cyril Fillot, a global strategist for consumer foods at Rabobank, digs into the data and brings us some of the numbers.
So what are the adoption rates? In the US, 12%, but there's some rumors and some mumblings that this is plateauing, this, and I'll come to that later on, why it might be plateauing as well. But around 12% of the adult population might be using one of those anti-obesity medications. In the UK, which is the largest market currently in Europe for these type of drugs, it's around 4%. So it's accelerated early last year, really. So 4% of the population. From a food point of view, how to think about it, and perhaps it's now 5% or 6%. And actually, I talked to one of the retailers in the UK who said it could be close to double digit now for that particular retailer. So it depends a bit on which segment you're working on. But how should we see this? Well, the number of vegetarians or vegans, 5-6%. And there's particular products for that audience, that segment in the supermarket or in food service. So I think this is a market already worth catering to. And it was interesting to hear that Tesco has these discussions already with suppliers about changing the offering or having a tailored offering for this. There will be a lot of these tailored type offerings to come going forward. This is the study that probably some of you have already seen, or most of you have already seen, but this is the big study in the US, again, going back to the US, that showed what the impact is on food spending. The study is called No Hunger Games. It's done by Cornell University. Download it. It's a massively interesting read. What they track for a large population of people, of which at least one person was on anti-obesity medication, the spending patterns on food. First conclusion, -6% in terms of spending. This is value, not volume. Volume might actually be even down more, and there may be a value opportunity here. But that's the first conclusion, which is an interesting one in itself. And I think this was already to be seen in when you looked at the publicly announced results of retailers and especially food service companies in the US and also their supply base into the US. US companies have had a tough time. And no, it's not the entire population, but they really have felt the impact already of this. Categories that are hit, you know, makes a lot of sense. Chips and savory, the snacking opportunity in general, which is the first two ones, the snacking opportunity has been impacted. Size makes also sense because of the portion of what people are willing to eat or have cravings for. Think about portion size, though, immediately. I think this is one where you can get and entice your consumers to buy something different. And salad dressings, not entirely sure why that is one, but it was one of the worst hit categories of them all. On the opportunity side, there were only four categories of food that were in plus territory. And we've already touched upon a few times, protein, whether it's yogurt, and Danone was here, but the Oikos brand in the Greek yogurt brand is doing phenomenally well in the US market right now. Fresh produce, healthier solutions, and also the halo effect that was talked about before, perhaps. Because the entire family eats and eat healthy. Meat snacks, which is perhaps a US thing. There was a boom-bust cycle in jerky, as you may remember. But other types of meat snacks are coming back in terms of sausages, for example, snack sausages. And nutrition bars, energy-dense, nutrition-dense type of food that people can have to still keep their nutrition going. Because they are not necessarily hungry. And they still need to have all those macronutrients and micronutrients. And protein, of course, is because of the perception that people need more protein because they lose muscle because of their weight loss and the associated lose of muscle with that. Not entirely sure whether that is science or just perception. A lot of this is, of course, perception. But the thing with yogurt is it's a spoonable snack. So it might replace, for an American consumer, a donut at 3 p.m., and just have a small cup of yogurt instead, which contains the protein, is healthy, and may help as well to break the day in principle.
Well, those market numbers paint a vivid picture, but behind every data point is a person. And in our next clip, we get much closer to the lived experience of what these drugs actually do to you. The panel at our Ascot event answered what happens to the way you eat. What are the side effects that nobody warns you about, and what happens to your body when you stop taking them?
Let's have a look now at what actually does to you and the body, and how it affects, you know, your relationship with food and how you behave around food and your eating pattern.
Yeah. So the medication has been developed at the beginning for diabetes, and it has been very well explained. It has an impact on society and how much food consumers are basically eating. So what we're observing is that consumers are eating definitively, in fact, less, which trigger, in fact, the weight loss. But on the same point, as they're eating less, they also had taste altered, meaning that they are not liking the same type of food. And we're seeing a big shift for the food and beverage industry, because we're seeing product category declining, like sweets, bakery type of food, snacks, sweet beverages, potentially alcohol, but we also see an increase in other category like nutritional bars, like yogurt, and especially high protein yogurt. And some, for example, producer had reported really seeing their sales and their revenue increasing in the US in this category, potentially due to the increased number of consumers being on GLP-1. We also see consumers eating much more fresh food, especially vegetables. On studies that we did at IFF, we had consumers telling us that they're craving now for vegetables, for salad, which never happened to them before. So that's really interesting. And the other thing on the food that it does, so then they're eating, in fact, less. It changed preferences, but they're also not drinking. So hydration is as well a problem for those consumers.
By not drinking, not just alcohol.
No, drinking even water. And consumers were reporting to us that they cannot drink any more sweet beverages, but that water is boring. And they're also reporting that they need to think to eat and to drink because the satiety level is very high. So then they don't feel hungry anymore. So they really need to remember that they need to eat, in fact, to get energy and to keep going with the body. Meaning that in terms of things to pay attention to, you definitely have so hydration with all the energy going there, but also muscle mass maintenance, which is a big one where you lose weight too quickly. So that's one that is very important, linking to the need of taking protein and high density food to sustain basically the need of your body on macro and micronutrient. Other things that the drug is doing is side effect on gut health. I don't know if someone wants to talk on this one.
I just wanted to add a little bit more on what you said. Taking a step back a little bit, like for decades, the weight management category was defined by diet, exercise, and stigma. In other words, eat less, move more, and feel bad about yourself when you don't. But GLP-1 has changed that mindset, so consumers are moving from trying to control their weight to looking for products that support their metabolism. So Sonia touched a little bit of indulgent categories. They'll have to make to get a makeover where they can put some high fibers in snacks or blood sugar friendly. So because consumer, they still want the pleasure, but they want some benefits built in. So yes, consumers still want chocolate, but they want it to love them back. So is where we see these new categories like satiety, supporting foods, which they are high in fiber, high in protein, with slow release carbs, healthy fats to make you feel fuller for longer, or metabolic support supplements, which they include botanical, probiotics, and like polyphenols, which support that energy metabolism. Also, as the GLP-1 changes your appetite, then we need to think about flavors, textures, and portion sizes. We know we need smaller portions, but with more sensory satisfaction. It's think about the quality of experience rather than the quantity of consumption. So if we zoom back, GLP-1 is doing something that very few innovation managed to, is changing the psychology of eating. So customer rethink what food and wellness are for. So in, I don't know, 5 years time, we might not be talking about weight management altogether. We can talk about metabolic harmony where foods and supplements are designed to help people feel in control and well-balanced. So the real question here is not what people will eat, is how we support them to eat well, feel well, and stay well in this new metabolic era.
And in relation, in fact, to that, that's when they are under medication. But as we talked at the beginning, there's a cost with the medication, and potentially they will not stay forever under medication. And the consumer reporting being really stressed on stopping the medication because they're stressed on bouncing back, of course, and because what happened to them is not by choice and not because they choose to eat differently and to have a different lifestyle. It's really the medication that is changing the ways that they are eating and interacting with food. So we see that there's also a big need to support them when they go off medication and to help them with products that will continue to basically fulfill them in terms of nutrition, in terms of society, and most probably as well in terms of coaching of what nutrition is.
So we've covered the science, the market, and the human impact, which brings us to the question that everyone in the food industry is really asking. Where does this go from here? And is there a role for food and nutrition rather than pharmaceutical drugs in managing GLP-1 pathways naturally? In our final clip, we hear from a session in Rotterdam that goes to the heart of the big strategic question for the food industry. Is GLP-1 a purely pharmaceutical story?
I always find it staggering. There's more people in the world obese than underweight. 1 billion people. I mean, I never thought I'd see in my lifetime that would be a leading cause of malnourishment. There's many people, many places in the world where that's the number one cause. But then we've got to think about how we've been approaching obesity up until now from a food, from a wellness ecosystem. We've reduced this complex idea into just a calorie equation. Eat less, move more. But surely it's more nuanced than that. It's more complicated than that. 1 billion people struggling, 15 million adults where I live in the UK are struggling. It just shows that we've got to think about this differently. This is a complex interplay of genetics, human behavior, and an increasingly aggressive obesogenic environment. We've tried lots of things. We've tried campaigns, public health initiatives. We've tried surgery, all with a varying amount of success. GLP-1 truly is a trend breaker because how we're addressing this problem is upstream. We're almost shielding the individual from the obesogenic environment. Jeffrey talked about how it works, and I'm just going to not spend too much time, but think about that again. These medications have been used for a very, very long time, since 2005, so 20 years. Safety profile is pretty impressive. And when we think about the use case, it was for type 2 diabetes, the unintended consequence is weight loss. And that's when I think the inflection point happened, around 2021, when Wegovy was approved by the FDA, and then in 2023, across the Western world and Europe, we started getting it approved for weight loss. Jeffrey kind of talked about how it works. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but I think it's important to understand how it works. Yeah, it's a feel-full hormone, so it makes you feel fuller for longer. It delays the gastric emptying, but it also acts on many other pathophysiological ways in the system. So the way your brain and brain chemistry is altered, so your preferences are altered. It acts on the inflammatory pathways in the body. There's now really strong evidence for heart health, where it's approved for heart health. There was a really interesting trial, the SELECT trial, that was done, showing that there was an incredible amount of positive impact of taking GLP-1 on heart health. There's green shoots on dementia, fertility. And I think we're just at this cusp of this. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this later, that the beachhead, the hook, the early proposition we're thinking about now is weight management. But I wouldn't necessarily limit this to something that's just limited. This is going to be, in my opinion, something that people would take as part of a very, very long lifestyle nutraceutical. And when you start thinking about it like that, you can start thinking and recognizing the opportunities to innovate, not just for now, but in the long term. So we talked about the problem with obesity. We talked about GLP-1, 20% weight loss. This is amazing. No, we've not had anything this efficacious in a very long time with relatively limited side effects. No wonder the uptake is huge. In the US, where we've got a lot of data, 25,000 new people a week are signing up to this. It's estimated that 10 to 12% of the adult population in the US have taken GLP-1. When you think about numbers, that's 25 to 35 million. That's huge. And who are these people? That's even more interesting, especially in the UK, that's out of pocket. And what's interesting from an opportunity perspective is these are young people, 25 to 40-year-olds, those that are paying out of pocket, so they have the thickest wellness wallet. That really becomes interesting. And sure, there's a challenge around access and the challenge around equity. But if I remove myself from that conversation just for a second and look at this from a commercial perspective, it shows that there's huge strategic profit pools to cater for this really health-curious, conscientious individual who's highly motivated with a really thick wellness wallet. So what's actually happening? So we talked about the science, we've talked about the uptake, but what's actually happening at an individual and therefore population level? There's studies in the US to show that once people start GLP-1, they're realizing around $203 a month of redirected spend. So this is what they would ordinarily spend on junk foods, takeaways. They're actually getting wealthier. This $203 has been redirected into premium products, foods, nutraceuticals. that's when it becomes really interesting. So there's changing preferences. People consciously and subconsciously are trying to align their spending to their wellness goals. They're thinking about, how do I have more protein? 40% of people are eating less sugar, less alcohol. Some studies are showing 36% drop in consumption of alcohol. But when you apply this at a population level, 25 to 35 million people who are drinking less alcohol, there's a huge opportunity to think about substitutes and alternatives. What does that actually mean? And that's what we want to start thinking about. The premiumization effect is something else. People are willing to spend more on good quality products. This GLP-1 consumer is willing to spend more on good quality products if they can see how the ingredients ladder up to the wellness goals. And that's something really to consider when we're thinking about opportunities to innovate in this space. But it's affected all sorts of aspects of life. We talked, Jeffrey talked about these t-shirt sizes, but it also affects dining out. So people who are thinking about dining out, some of the more flexible and forward-thinking restaurants are catering their menu towards this, a GLP-1 friendly diet. But they're doubling down on the other things, the entertainment. People on GLP-1 still want to socialize. We don't just go out to eat just to fill our stomachs, otherwise you just go to the fridge. It's about theater, it's about social aspects, it's about the whole experience. This thing is often coined as now eatertainment. And that's something that's quite interesting. Those that are thinking about the experiential element are going to be in strong stead to take advantage of this. So what are the growth areas? If you look at the life cycle, I'm going to just be really simplistic. Right now, we're thinking about, you think about the onboarding phase, a bit like taking a flight here. The onboarding phase, a bit steady, a few side effects. Then it's the maintenance phase. And then it's the mastery. And we don't have quite enough people on the mastery bit. And I'll explain a bit more about what I mean. At the takeoff, at the first bit, this is when people struggle with most side effects. So what are the obvious side effects? 50% of people have GI side effects. The slowing down of gastroparesis. They're not sure about how they have hydration. They're not sure about the meals that they're eating. They're eating meals that are too big and not necessarily nutrient dense. But when you get to maintenance, once you get over that, this is when it becomes interesting. Sure, you lose 20% of body weight, but 40% of that could be lean muscle mass. And this is what people start getting into as they get further and further in this life cycle. They're jumping on the scales and they think, actually, I'll buy a better scale. Ooh, my BMI, my muscle mass is something that's being cannibalized. That's not great for wellness outcomes. Then they start thinking, actually, my skin's losing elasticity and is looking a bit saggy. And they start thinking of focusing on different aspects of health and wellness. They may be doing blood tests and realizing HbA1c, the blood sugar marker, or cholesterol is improving, and they become more vested into those kinds of things beyond weight management. So that's what's quite interesting. And then you get towards mastery, which is where behavior change apps are really focusing on not just weight management, which is the hook in, but how do we optimize someone's health and well-being? We talked about like some of the strategic profit pools, and I think I'm just going to touch on 3 or 4 high-level trends and then take it back to where I think the future is going to be. So that the trends are very much focused towards the use case right now, which is weight management. I think that's a relatively short-term use case. Nevertheless, where are the strategic profit pools? Well, it's about high-quality protein. You've got to have 1 gram per kilogram of protein to maintain your muscle mass. And so there's going to be a demand and an ever-growing demand for animal and plant-based proteins, but also novel sources of proteins, pea, fava, and precision fermented proteins. You know, it's prized for its role in satiety. Protein is an important role for muscle preservation and also metabolic health. The other ingredient, the other area is going to be fiber. So fiber-rich ingredients, but functional fibers, fibers such as those that contain inulin, resistant starches, and beta-glucans. These are really important, thinking about weaving some of these in to support wellness goals in the long term, to support satiety and support gut health is going to be really important. But we also talked about how people are eating. They're eating smaller meals more frequently. That doesn't mean they're getting healthier. They're at risk of micro-deficiencies. So nutrient-dense and micronutrients rich in iron, B12, and essentially rich in the nutrients will help prevent micro-deficiencies. But I'm going to take it back now to the future. So we talked about problem. Problem is big, obesity. It's a complex problem. GLP-1 helps to shield at the top of that funnel, but it's a relatively blunt tool. people need to think about how do we support an individual throughout their life cycle. Right now, we're doing that for weight management through side effects and then weight maintenance. But you've got to think about the future of GLP-1. New modalities will be coming out. People will be consuming this in a very different way, is my hypothesis. So when you've got an oral form at a lower dose with less side effects, and the formulation changes, side effects becomes a non-issue. So you're innovating for side effects now, but that might be irrelevant in 12 months' time. So you've got to have your finger on the pulse on what is going to be the future. And my prediction, my hypothesis is this is very much going to be a lifestyle nutraceutical, something you take all of the time. And it will be these new and non-traditional incumbents that will help to display your inner dashboard. So beyond weight management, what's going on with heart health, brain health, fertility, and so forth. And wherever that wellness goal is, you've got to redirect your portfolio to support those wellness needs. Because the trends, the big things won't change. That is, people are going to be richer because of this redirected spend. They're going to be more vested. But they also need to be—they also prepare to spend on premium products to support those wellness goals. Right now, that wellness goal is weight management, but actually, beyond weight management, you can expect heart health, brain health, fertility, inflammation, and a whole host of other things to be woven through. And we don't know how people are going to be using this. Is it going to be microdosing? Are they going to be pulsing? Will it be in a lower dose? So that's what I'm preparing you for. Don't necessarily put all of your eggs in one basket and think side effects and food. GLP-1, in my opinion, is here to stay for a very, very long time. It's just that we don't know how we're going to be using it.
So there you have it. The GLP-1 story doesn't appear to be going anywhere fast. And although there are obvious challenges for the food industry, there are plenty of opportunities too. Thank you for listening. You can find more episodes at foodmatterslive.com, where you can also find out more and secure tickets for our next event, which is taking place in London on the 3rd and 4th of June.